This is Audible.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents Straying, a novel by Molly McCloskey. Read by Katie Bedare.
How do people do it? I used to wonder. Well, I learned. That sort of secret feels like an illness, the way the world slows to a crawl as though for your inspection. So much clarity and consequence. It was like enlightenment. It was like being in the truth, which is a funny thing to say about deceit. One afternoon, at the close of that sweltering summer, when Collie and I were still in our trance, I found myself traveling west with him by train. I found myself, not to suggest some condition of passivity. I was the one who insisted we make the journey. But because when I look back, I have the sense that I'd come suddenly to consciousness right there, on that bockety old orange and black train, as it made its clamorous way across the countryside. We were standing between carriages, jostled by the train's motion. A Wheaton light streamed through the open window. Fresh air was flooding in, too. The day's heat was fading to a sweet residue. We braced ourselves against the wall, drinking bottles of cold beer and sharing a silk cut. Those were the days when no one minded if the air was fouled with smoke. The days when you could slide down the window in the door and hang your head out, happy as a dog. I pressed my lips to Collie's neck, which was cool and sticky. Collie was fair, and in the heat his skin got clammy as a baby's. Together we watched the country slide past in frames. The fields, green and empty, or full of sheep who didn't stir when we whooshed by. Then, patches of weedy cracked tarmac surrounded by chain-link fences. Then the back gardens of houses, with their propped bikes, and their coal bunkers, and the flotsam of family life. And then, all was green again. And there were cows where sheep had been, and a breaker's yard, and a bungalow sitting proud on a hill. We leaned out the window, and the wind whipped over our faces. And I felt as alive and unencumbered as if we'd hopped a boxcar. I was married at the time, but not to Collie. I found our old house, Eddie's and mine, on the internet not long ago. It's for sale. I track him on occasion through the vast electronic undergrowth, imagining who he'd be now if things had gone another way. The first time, I'd only meant to look around the neighborhood. To get a glimpse of the facade. I wanted to see the mountain, and the view of the Atlantic, the fuchsia that grew at the corner of the drive. But what came up when I searched were the property websites, and there was the house, listed by its name. I'd forgotten it even had a name. I'm doing it again, sitting in the third floor bedroom of my temporary home in Dublin, clicking from picture to picture, a thin sense of omnipotence upon me. There are things I recognize. A standing lamp, a pair of leather armchairs, the dining table we chose together. Furniture surprises me with its betrayals, its easy migration between lives. What I didn't notice until today is something my mother gave us the last time she visited. It's hanging on the wall in the spare bedroom, a print she bought in town and had framed, abstract and muted, and thus somewhat out of character for her, which was why I had liked it. I couldn't figure out what had drawn her to it. Did I forget to bring it with me when I left? Or did it just seem petty to start taking things off the walls? My mother is dead now. She died 8 weeks ago, and I cannot decide how I feel about the fact that some part of her has remained in that house without me. Also on the wall, taped up in the kitchen, are drawings made by a child, or children. In the living room, a few framed photos that refuse to sharpen into focus. Otherwise, the interiors are oddly impersonal. Eddie remarried several years ago, but the master bedroom has been stripped of anything that might indicate the kind of couple who have been occupying it. It looks unlived in, like a bedroom in a B&B. Eddie and I bought the house from a woman who suffered from anorexia. The estate agent said she was selling because she was too sick to look after it herself and was going to Dublin, where she had family. She wasn't there on either of the occasions we viewed it, though there was one photo of her on the kitchen windowsill, standing with someone who might have been a brother. Her skin was a strange nut brown. She wore big, round glasses that made her face look small and childlike, and her neck was like a stick. Eddie said under his breath, "God love her," and I slipped my arm around his waist as though to earth us. The second time we visited, we stood side by side, peering through the big kitchen window which faced the long western flank of the Table Mountain that dominated the landscape behind the house. In profile, the mountain looked like a wave frozen at the point of breaking. We were very close to it, on the highest road running parallel, and the large back garden sloped perceptibly upwards. The garden had been let go completely, the growth so thick in places it had thatched itself into a weave. We imagined reclaiming it. We saw a wooden deck, breakfasts al fresco, late nights looking at the stars. "Shall we do it?" Eddie whispered, and I nodded, rather gravely as I recall. I thought it was what we needed. I thought it would lend our marriage some weight it seemed to lack. We made an offer that afternoon. After we moved in, I used to go out back on certain summer mornings and hack away at the garden with rudimentary tools. What was wrong with us? We needed a plan, a proper digger, and a professional, and there was I with a pair of shears and a rusty shovel and a hangover. I came to this country at the tail end of the 1980s, when I was 24. I packed up my belongings and stored them in the house my mother shared with her husband in the suburbs of Portland, Oregon, promising I'd be back for them, and intending to be. She saw me off at the airport, both excited and apprehensive. I was her only child. She had raised me on her own, and I sometimes felt her holding my existence in a kind of awe, as though I were newly born. She was also cautious with money and considered my adventure a little feckless. I was leaving two jobs, one of which she'd been sure was going to lead somewhere. Mornings, I worked at a nonprofit that advocated for the homeless and ran a men's shelter, checking people in and out, doing admin or bits of research, sometimes doing not much at all, just hanging around with homeless men in a way that was meant to convey that we, people with homes and people without homes, were all in this together. Nights, I worked in the sports department of a daily newspaper, writing brief summaries of minor games and the very occasional feature. Both jobs tended to muddy the already indistinct view I had of myself. When I was at work in the morning, I imagined I could see a better me on the horizon, someone impassioned and unself-conscious, preoccupied with justice. But at night, surrounded by the buzz of the newsroom, I saw my byline repeating into infinity, growing as big as a billboard, as my fame spread beyond that peripheral city. In other words, I didn't know who I was, or what I really valued, and I began to think that I should take myself away for a spell to find out. I should go to Europe. I had a savings account into which each week I deposited some tiny sum. Eventually, I realized that at the rate I was saving, it would be years before I had enough to fund a European tour, and that perhaps I needed to trim my ambitions. And so, I went to Ireland. I flew into London because that way was cheapest, and immediately upon landing boarded the train west for Holyhead and the ferry. I disembarked in Dunleary on an unremarkable April day into a hard, white light that surprised me. The breeze was almost balmy, and what looked to me like palm trees along the harbour road added to the illusion that I had arrived somewhere other than an island in the North Atlantic. I headed north and west, and for 2 weeks drifted around Donegal, standing on grassy verges, hitting lifts in the drizzle. It was mostly lorry drivers who stopped for me, and I would hoist myself gamely into the passenger seat. From the windows I could see over the hedgerows into the fields. Low walls warmed this way and that, sectioning the land into parcels. The skies were a sudsy grey, or nicotine yellow, or they were charcoal and ready to burst. The drivers all asked the same three questions, and all of them had cousins in New York. They were like no men I had ever met, both knowing and a little slow, faintly lecherous and yet disarmingly innocent. They seemed as awed by me as I was by them, and cast furtive, sidelong glances in my direction, as though I might combust at any moment. One night, in the fishing village of Killybegs, in a pub down by the harbour, I met a middle-aged couple named Bill and Lil. They were from somewhere outside Derry and, for reasons unclear to me, kept an apartment in Killybegs. Was he a fishing magnet? Was it a love nest? Their double act seemed a bit too zesty to pass for marriage. Overweight and florid-faced, their exuberance tinged with despair, Bill and Lil swept me into their orbit with a desperate generosity. They drank buckets of Black Tower, and I drank it with them, over a dinner they treated me to of grilled plaice. At some point, I heard myself say, in a manner I'd have thought too unconvincing to elicit any reaction at all, let alone the one it got, that I might go to Galway and look for a summer job. Upon hearing this, Bill heaved himself up from his chair, and, with one hand in the air, as though to deliver an oration that would be quoted down the ages, said, "I know a fella in Galway owns a pub." When I didn't protest, there seemed no point. We had entered that state of drunkenness in which life becomes a thought experiment, and we were merely teasing out a scenario that began with my working in a pub in Galway. Bill lumbered off in the direction of the bar, to use the phone. When he rejoined us, he said that he hadn't got hold of his friend, but he'd phoned another friend, one who had a pub in Sligo. "Sligo?" I said. I hadn't even planned to stop there. "Who?" Lil asked. Bill lowered his girth back into the chair. "Dom Conway. You know Dom." "Oh, aye." Lil looked at me, and her head gave a little wobble of pride. "Bill knows lads everywhere. You're to call into him tomorrow."
"Tomorrow?"
Lil asked if I'd ever done bar work. I looked around. The woman behind the bar was chatting to a guy whose little finger was a stump at the knuckle. She was holding his hat in one hand and a pint glass in the other. The lager ran down the inside of the glass until she knew without looking that the glass was full. She let go of the tap, and it slapped back into place. Then she flicked a beer mat down like she was dealing a card and placed the pint atop it. There were other people sitting at the bar, all of the men, all with hands like paws. The barwoman chatted to them as one, leaning back against the countertop behind her, her arms crossed. When someone shook a smoke from his pack and offered it to her, she took it and lit it, then left it to smolder in one of those old glass ashtrays you could brain a burglar with. There were small tables around the lounge area and maroon-upholstered benches along the wall where the courting couple sat, primly dressed, looking shy and virginal. At intervals, the young men would approach the bar and get a pint for themselves and something mixed for their companions. Everyone regarded everyone else with a strange blend of intimacy and disregard. "I've done a little," I lied. We stayed well past closing time, and although we had long since run out of things to say and kept falling back on talk of my new job and what a brilliant spot Sligo was, I was carried on the wave of their enthusiasm. We raised our glasses a dozen times in triumph. At some point, Lil got out a camera and we took Polaroids of each other. We arranged the prints on our small round table and cooed and clucked as they developed, as though we were viewing a basket of kittens. Then Lil, suddenly serious, gathered up the photos and turned to me, with that dumb and startled look that is the mark of someone drunk and burdened with an emotion that eludes expression, and pressed them into my hand, like ducats for the road, or amulets for my protection. I checked into a youth hostel in Sligo town that faced onto the river. The proprietor at the time was an openly gay black Frenchman, and this gave me a completely skewed idea of what I should expect from the town. The front room had a large plate glass window, and in a parallelogram of sunlight that lay across the manky carpet, a pair of beautiful Danes played checkers every day, rearranging their long limbs at intervals. When they weren't playing checkers, or out hill walking, or cooking brown rice, they did nothing, in a way that seemed to me distinctly European. There was one other long-term resident, a willowy young Irish woman named Jane, who was a student at the local technical college. Jane talked about the environment, and alluded to political corruption as though it were a thing we had discussed at length and were in agreement on. She was canny and skeptical in a way I wasn't used to, and she intimidated me. Every day at 5 o'clock, she turned the transistor in the kitchen to RTE1 for the news on Tiananmen Square. This was often around the time I had to go to work. I had 5 shifts at Conway's, and in my white blouse and black skirt, I would head out past Jane and the Danes, feeling foolish and American. I had imagined Conway's as the kind of sleepy, familial scene I had witnessed in the pubs in Donegal, but it was frequented by a different kind of crowd. Bank clerks, nurses, solicitors, and civil servants. And most nights they were 3 deep at the bar. One weekday evening, when it was quiet, I was told I could clock out early. As I headed to the door, two guys I had never seen in the pub before invited me to go elsewhere with them for a drink. "We'll take you somewhere interesting. Somewhere you'll enjoy," they said, as though they knew exactly what would interest and amuse me, which was not a million miles from the truth. To be a young American woman in a small Irish town in the years when foreigners were still scarce was to enjoy the status of a minor celebrity, and I was growing used to the fact that many people of whose existence I was completely ignorant knew where I worked, slept, and ate my lunch. Their names were Frank and Martin, and they took me to a pub on Bridge Street where the stuffing erupted through vinyl benches and the air stank of patchouli. It was smoky and dark, and the woman wore harem pants. We met two friends of Frank and Martin's there. They had all been in a band together and had almost made it big in some hazy past and were, I gathered, ever on the brink of making a comeback. Frank was a drummer, and he had tight curls and a driven intensity that had no obvious outlet. The others were different, pensive and enigmatic. They had lank, rained-on-looking hair and an air of aggrieved entitlement, like people who'd been done out of an inheritance. At closing time, Frank said we were all going out to the beach at Lissadel, and I squeezed into the back of someone's clapped-up Micra, and we sped through the dark without seatbelts. At Lissadel, we sprawled on the sand, and Martin lit a thick, crooked joint that tasted mostly like a cigarette. We passed it among us, and as I stared up at the velvet sky, the heavens seemed to pull up and away as though they might lift us right off the earth with them. I met the band guys regularly after that, and soon I was venturing into the edgier pubs on my own. One night in the pub on Bridge Street, I met a Canadian woman, about my age, named Camille. She was a stranger in town too, but far less self-conscious than I was. She was here because she'd met an Irish woman the previous spring in Toronto, and they had fallen madly in love. Camille had followed the women back here, and they had set up house in a damp cottage a few miles from town. But the woman had, almost immediately upon their arrival, broken it off, and here was Camille, rolling with the novelty of it all, and planning her next move. She was stunningly beautiful. She had a pixie haircut, bleached blonde, and was slim as a schoolboy. She wore white V-neck t-shirts and tight jeans and combat boots. When I met her, she told me she was planting a garden using the only implements at her disposal, a spoon and a fork. She didn't drink much, but she loved a party, and would sit squashed skinnily in our booth as though she'd been born to this. When a group of us was out for an evening, there was always a moment when the night either petered out in good sense and an air of anticlimax, or assumed a sudden momentum, as though time were running out on something, and it would begin again, that urgent merrymaking with no apparent cause. What Ireland at the end of the 80s often resembled was a place celebrating, insistently, its own collapse. And there was a certain dignity in that, a triumph even. At closing time, we'd all stumble over to Martin's bedsit, where we smoked sprinklings of hash mixed with tobacco. It burned my throat and left me with a dim, headachy high, and a passing sadness for my new friends. This way of getting stoned, so parsimonious and approximate, seemed emblematic of the way they made do. I knew that one day a week they all went to the dole office. I imagined it as one might a methadone clinic or a needle exchange, and I hoped for all our sakes that I would never see them coming or going from there. I met Eddie in the midst of those weeks, trailing a hangover that was beginning to feel cumulative. Normally, after a heavy night, I would lie late in my bunk, then trudge about the drab town, past the window displays of cheap shoes and flouncy dresses, past the butcher shops with their hanging carcasses that sent a smell like sour milk onto the street. I would eat my lunch in one of the tea houses, a toasted cheese or pureed vegetable soup, dutifully reading my paperback Yeats, or attempting to work through the thicket of cross-referencing and assumed knowledge that was the Irish Times. But the day I met Eddie dawned so fine I roused myself at a reasonable hour and borrowed Jane's bike and pedaled out the sea road to Ross's Point. The gorse was scrambling up the hillsides, and the skies were freshly blue. The world gleamed in a wash of wet yellow light. When I got back to the hostel, the Danes invited me to join them for an early supper. They made a salad of cucumbers and butterhead lettuce, and those tomatoes that tasted of nothing at all, like something astronauts might eat. They'd cooked a fresh fish whole, which the three of us flayed messily and devoured, sitting in the grass in front of the hostel, looking out across the bay to the Atlantic. Just before 6, I put on my blouse and skirt and set off for the brief walk to Conway's. I was in good spirits. I felt clean in my skin and hopeful, though of nothing in particular. I saw myself as though from above, walking jauntily up O'Connell Street in the lingering sun of early evening, and felt fond and a little nostalgic, as though the night ahead were an experience I was already looking back on. When I walked through the door of the pub, I saw a man sitting at the end of the bar, chatting to Dom's wife. He followed me with his eyes as I moved behind the counter and began unloading the glass washer. When Dom's wife wandered off, he ordered a pint of Guinness, and I served him a thin-headed thing he didn't complain about. I guessed he was in his early 30s, though his hair was already thinning. He had heavy eyelids, which left him looking both sleepy and aroused, and a nose that made me picture his profile on a coin. He was a big man, and he had the look that big men often do. Unguarded, somehow made vulnerable by their very heft, like certain slow-moving animals, so that you do not know whether to regard them with pity and tenderness, or, on the contrary, to exercise extreme vigilance in their presence. He thumbed through a paper, and when I passed his way again, he looked up and held my gaze, and I felt embarrassed by the lowliness of my work. In his crisp, striped, button-down shirt, he appeared to be a man of means. I could see he was like none of the friends I'd made in town. "So what brings you here?" he asked. "Vacation," I said. "Some vacation, eh?" He looked around. I smiled. "What do you do?" It was a very American question, and I immediately regretted it. He took a big swallow of his pint. It left a line of foam on his lip, and he ran the tip of his tongue expertly over it and sat up a little straighter. "Furniture. I import it and export it." I didn't know what to say. I knew nothing about furniture, and even less about importing and exporting. Over his left shoulder, the sun was coming in through the tall windows that faced onto O'Connell Street. It was the summer of a general election, and I could see the streetscape quilted with candidates' posters, a confusion of faces buckling on the lampposts. I wished I knew enough to remark on it all, something pithy and elliptical, the sort of thing Jane might say. But it was an event I couldn't gauge the seriousness of. All the tattered bunting and the megaphones blaring from the roofs of cars gave it the feel of an election in a banana republic, or a student council campaign. "What I meant," he said, realizing that he'd reduced me to silence, "was how did you end up here?" He tipped his head to indicate Conway's. "Oh, here," I said, and I told him about Bill and Lil. He listened closely, shaking his head every so often in enjoyment. I smiled again, and tried to look adventurous without giving the impression that I do whatever any passerby suggested. "So you're around for the summer?" I hesitated. I didn't want to say that I'd be leaving at summer's end, nor did I want him to think I was indentured to Conway's indefinitely. I looked down and noticed an afterimage of ketchup on my cuff, and said, to my own great surprise, "I'm thinking of going into journalism." "Was I? Why not?" Judging by those campaign cavalcades, the public sphere was slight and unserious, nothing I couldn't get a handle on. "Really?" He sounded unfazed. That was Eddie, I would learn. I could say almost anything, even things I surprised myself with, and he'd hardly bat an eye. And I never did figure out if he really believed in me, or if he just didn't take my notions too seriously. "I worked at a paper at home." "You were a journalist?" "Trying." He gave me a soft little smile and said, with the gentlest hint of world weariness, "Sure, what more can you do?" We made a date for the following Sunday. On the weekends or my evenings off, Eddie would pick me up and would zoom through the countryside, his triumph gripping the road, the hedges pressing in with their full summer growth. We went for oysters in Ochterard and smoked salmon in Westport. He took me into a castle in Kerry, and another in Donegal, and to big country houses and tiny little pubs, where in dark nooks we canoodled over milky pints. He took me to an island of beehive huts, to the Shannon, to a bistro at the far side of a border checkpoint, where helicopters hovered overhead. He took me to an abattoir, and I saw the blood running down the gutters, and met a man in spattered coveralls who was charmed by my interest in slaughter. Sometimes we just drove and drove, to a waterfall or a piece of land he hankered after, or a high-up boring with a particularly fine view. Everywhere cottages crumbled. I had the foreigner's eye, acquisitive, ignorant, romantic. And I would say as we passed, "What about that one? Do you think that could be fixed up?" And sometimes he would laugh, and sometimes he would weigh the possibilities, and sometimes he would tell me a story about who owned the land and the intractable knot the deeds were in, and I would be astounded that such places should be let go to ruin. As though they were nothing. That you could buy a plot with a sea view for less than you'd spend on a car. I recall a signal midnight downpour, parked in Eddie's car above the beach at Ross's Point. The world through the windscreen a rich black smear, as though painted in oils. Otherwise, it was the sort of summer in which every day dawned clear and blue, and the seas glittered in the sunlight. The sort of summer whose extreme rarity every person I knew attempted to impress on me, so that a certain unreality attached itself to those months. People flocked to the beaches, looking hazardously pale. The first time Eddie and I went to the beach together, I could hardly look at him. I had, by that point, seen him without clothes. We'd had our first, somewhat awkward sex in the flat where he lived above his showroom and office, but it was still the case that I had seen him naked only in shadowy interiors, and I was surprised that day when he stripped down to his trunks, his costume as he called it, and I saw that he was as pale as all the rest. We were on the wide second strand at Ross's Point. For a moment I averted my eyes, as though out of courtesy, and took in the scene. Dogs romped in the shallow surf, and children squealed, and families munched on sandwiches they'd packed. The beach lacked, like no beach I had ever visited, any tinge whatsoever of the erotic, and I detected a kind of happiness that was simpler and truer than the vehement bonhomie of nighttime. One evening in mid-August, we met friends of Eddie's for dinner in Mullochmore, on the coast about 20 minutes north of town. When we arrived at the restaurant, the others were already seated. Two couples at a picnic table outside, scanning the menus, talking without looking up. An apricot tint hung over the harbor, where tiny fishing boats bobbed, and I marveled at the fact that anyone would take such toys out into the open sea. Eddie introduced me. They were all professionals, the wives too. A doctor, a dentist, a solicitor, and an architect, and all around Eddie's age. We sat and ordered drinks, and there followed the obligatory exclamations of wonder regarding the weather. And then a discussion resumed that had begun before we got there, which concerned the attempted reform of a Byzantine European agricultural policy that had resulted in mountains of excess butter and lakes of milk. I tried to look interested, without looking so interested that someone might ask me what I made of it all. But no one asked, and no one offered to explain anything. And I was sure I detected a pleasure in the discussion that was independent of its rather dull particulars. There was nothing like the presence of an outsider to heighten one's enjoyment of being an insider. By the time the food arrived, plates of mussels and black sole, boulangère potatoes, broccoli and carrots, the talk had turned to America. One of the men asked what part I was from. I said Oregon. And one of the women said, "I was at a conference in Seattle once. It rained for 4 solid days, and the others laughed, and someone said to me, "You're at home here, so. So tell us about Oregon. Tell us about America. Explain America to us." Everyone laughed again. I could tell they wanted me to reveal to them some side of America they hadn't seen before, but I also knew that I was expected to demonstrate a weary cynicism about the place, to mock its excesses and presumptions. And the expectation gave rise to a defensiveness in me. One of the things I loved about Eddie was that he was never cheaply superior or condescending. He liked that I came from the New World. He'd never wanted to live there, but he was a businessman, and he regarded my country as fast and sharp and entrepreneurial. When he spoke of America, it was with amused, half-baffled admiration, the way you might speak of someone who had no shame, but who sometimes, in spite of himself, got it right. I said something about what a big place America was, and how many different Americas existed, and how difficult it was to say anything conclusive about America, or even about Americans, who were, after all, people from all over the world. And they murmured their agreement, but seemed disappointed by the sincerity of my reply, its lack of wit or indirection. After that, they didn't press for my opinions, nor did they ask about my plans, which came as a relief. I had no plans beyond the summer, and still felt, as I did with Jane at the hostel, distressingly short of opinions. What they did want for me was to be assured that I was enjoying myself in their country, as though I were a friend's child they'd been tasked with amusing for the day. I said, "Yes, of course I am," and one of the men said, "What's not to like?" And they all chuckled in a way that suggested there were many things not to like, and I would discover them if I stuck around. I laughed along, as though I knew just what they meant. But it was one of those moments when all the conviviality and all the laughter seemed only a cover for what lay beneath, a teeming, tricky, intricately coded world. An earnest-looking young woman came to collect our plates, and when she departed, carrying the stack in her arms like a pile of laundry, the doctor leaned back against the still warm wall of the pub, surveyed the scene with a proprietorial eye, and said with exaggerated satisfaction, "We'll never have to go to the continent again." The continent. Irish people were always zipping off to the continent, to the south of France, or Sicily, or Portimao. People who seemed comfortable, but not terribly well-to-do. And I was puzzled, even vaguely affronted, by the seeming extravagance of it. But I was careful not to say anything straightforward or wide-eyed. "How often do you go to the continent?" Or ever to appear surprised by anything. I had seen that what gave rise to the greatest derision was the tendency of Americans to be both credulous and easily impressed. Mostly I let Eddie talk for us, and relaxed into the atmosphere of enveloping disregard, both unnerved and relieved by my relative invisibility and my looming obsolescence. Just a few days before, Eddie had told me, quite casually, that he had always hated Conway's pub, and had come in that evening only because a friend had said there was a Yank behind the bar, and he should have a look. We were in town, walking up Harmony Hill, and I stopped. What I had assumed was a serendipitous encounter had in fact been a sizing up. "I see," I said, "like a tip on a horse." He looked askance at me and shook his head. He actually looked hurt. "Not at all," he said. I felt disoriented, beset by a suspicion that would, from time to time, revisit me, that there was more to why things happened here than I was capable of comprehending. "So am I your date for the summer?" I asked. "Well," he said, and traced a finger around my lips, "it depends on what you want to be." I tried to leave him. At the end of that summer, he tried to let me. We were testing ourselves. In September, I went to Greece. I said I might also go to Italy, maybe even France, and that in a few weeks I would come back to Ireland for my things, and then I would go home. I had no prospects here, after all, nor did I have the right to stay indefinitely. Even impoverished little nations that hemorrhaged their citizens had immigration controls. Eddie said that he would write. He never felt comfortable writing anything, and the letter he wrote to me while I was in Greece was the only one he wrote during our years together. It came to the American Express office in Athens, where I picked it up along with two letters from my mother. I read it on the train to Piraeus over and over, and it may be the thing I recall most vividly about that whole trip. It wasn't that Eddie said anything profound or terribly revealing. It was just the tone of it. The fine simplicity of the style and of the sentiments. The presumption, was I imagining it, that after I returned to Ireland, I would not leave. Neither of us had wanted to take responsibility for moving the thing beyond a holiday romance. But here was Eddie, writing so easily about the everyday, as though our story were ongoing rather than ending. And what I wanted more than anything was to dissolve into him, into that presumption. Maybe it should have worried me, that desire for dissolution. But I was not sure how grown-up love was supposed to feel, and so I took this desire for its true mark. I took my unhappiness as an indication, too. In Greece, I was lonely and lethargic. But I was trying to prove something, to myself and to Eddie, that I had not disappeared into him, that I had a life to be getting on with, that I, too, could go to the continent. I had come all this way, after all. Surely I should visit Europe proper, the cradle of its civilization. And it was amazing, the Parthenon floating above the smog-choked, traffic-clogged city, like memory made solid, like thunder itself resting up there on the hill. On the island of Crete, I stayed in the guest room of a woman who was somewhere between 50 and 70. She was thick-set, draped in black, warted and whiskered like someone in a fairy tale. She had hardly a word of English, and I, of course, had no Greek. But she treated me with excessive solicitude, as though something terribly unfortunate had befallen me, which, in her eyes, it had. I was alone. Her own children were in Athens and London. Her husband was dead. She lived alone now herself, but she had married, spawned, mourned. She brought me lunches of hard white cheese and thick sliced bread, and the sweetest tomatoes. Sometimes there were whole fish on the plate, no larger than my index finger, which she'd arranged in a fan shape. There was always a pool of olive oil. Every meal tasted of the sea and of sun. I felt myself coming to rest in her care. She seemed to know something I didn't. She could read my moods. I had a book in which I actually ticked off the days until I could go back to Eddie, until I could allow him to look after me. And somehow, she seemed to know what I wanted. And wanted for me. And I took this wish of hers as a benediction. I went back to him. In my absence, the season had turned. The mountains were a charcoal green, rucked in a collar of low clouds, and the fields were marshy and rush-spiked. Those ruins that on long summer evenings, softened by moss fur and the tumble of wisteria, had had the look of walled gardens, in the gloom were as bereft as tombstones. Weather pressed in off the Atlantic, and you felt buffeted and alive as though at sea. When the cloud cover broke, the rain-drenched blues and greens glistened silver, and the world was as bright as a mirror, and it hurt to look. I rented a little house in town for £40 a week. The floor sloped slightly, and the ceilings were low and also sloped. The sitting room and bedroom were covered in a thin, bristly carpet that was hardly softer than an outdoor mat. To get light, I had to ply a wall-mounted grey box with 50-pence pieces, a situation that struck me as larky and amusing, as did so many other things that winter. The 3-bar heater that I carried like a handbag from room to room. The gas supercer, which on those rare occasions when I hit its pair of buttons just right and managed to ignite the thing, could heat the small bedroom to the temperature of hell, the way the walls felt as moist as a cave's. No amount or form of heat would dry that house, and my nose dripped like a dog's in the dusky sitting room. But we can live easily with many things, and minor inconveniences can seem infinitely interesting, if we are young, or there is novelty, or if we are in love. Eddie lived by the docks, in the flat above his showroom. He'd been working with furniture since his early 20s, when he'd apprenticed himself to a cabinet maker in the UK. When he came home, he started his own small cabinetry shop, which had grown into the import-export business. He had a couple of high-end craftsmen whose work he sold abroad. Eddie had an aesthete's love of fine things, tailored suits, Italian shoes, good wine, handcrafted furniture, that seemed at odds with his otherwise no-nonsense approach to life. But in the late 80s, his mainstay was importing middle-of-the-road stuff for bungalow dwellers. The flat wasn't much, a space he'd converted himself. But at night, I loved to look out the window and see the lights across the water from the housing estate, and, further out, the lights from Ross's Point. In a heavy mist, or with the rain coming down like cold grit and the black water slapping against the quay, I imagined us lovers on the run in some desolate Baltic port. We hadn't talked much during the summer about our past romances. Eddie could be gregarious, but he was tight-lipped about the big things, like money and love. And I had made the mistake of thinking that because he hadn't said a lot about his past, it meant there wasn't a lot to say. It was also true that I didn't want to know, not too much anyway. I'd felt safe with Eddie from early on, partly because he was tight-lipped. It made me feel he could hold things, the difficult, messy things, and contain them for the two of us. He didn't probe too deeply about my past, which puzzled me in the beginning, because it didn't feel like disregard. With Eddie, I felt both loved and left alone, my privacy's intact. And though the formulation struck me then as miraculous, I later wondered if he hadn't granted me freedoms I was too young and unwise to handle. Not long after we met, He had mentioned a nurse from Claire who'd been working at a hospital in town. But it was only that winter, when we were eating dinner in the flat one night, that he told me they'd almost become engaged a couple of years ago. In the end, she couldn't commit to settling down here. She followed her brother to Australia, he said. She was hoping I'd come out at some point, at least try it. Weren't you tempted? He shrugged, almost apologetic, as though I would think less of him for having played it safe. I had a business here, he said. To pack it all in? I don't know. Did you miss her? I meant, of course, do you miss her? I was imagining the nurse returning, Eddie gone in an instant. I was picturing her in her starched nurse's uniform, bustling and competent and sexy. For a while, I guess, I hoped she'd come back. You did? He looked at me quizzically, then smiled. Don't worry, he said. It petered out. I haven't heard anything of her in over a year. I don't even have her address. My last relationship had been with a man from the newspaper office in Portland. He was older, maybe 40, attractive in a craggy, intelligent, distracted sort of way. He was a columnist, someone I'd admired from afar before bumping into him. Literally, we collided on a street corner, in my neighborhood one night. When I told him I worked at the homeless shelter, he went on a rant about dubious rezoning proposals aimed at gentrifying my employers out of existence. He wanted me to blow the lid off some scandal I hadn't even known existed. We dated for a couple of months, during which I cleaved to the idea that our chance encounter was a sign that we were meant to be. But eventually I admitted to myself that he was imperious and impatient. He had little sympathy for hesitation or uncertainty or self-doubt. And if I was anything at 23, it was hesitant and uncertain and full of doubt. I knew that if I were to continue seeing him, I would need to toughen up. And I wanted that. I really did. I didn't like swimming in doubt. He wanted it too. But when I thought of how I might become tough and sure, I felt so inadequate to the task that, instead of growing larger over those months, I retreated. Some of this I explained to Eddie, who winced as though in pain. He said that I was grand just the way I was. And when I asked him what he meant, he said, "You don't have to prove anything to me." The night we got engaged, we drank champagne in his flat. I sat on his lap and he asked, "How does it feel?" And I said, with mock gravity and not a little awe, "I feel quite old and serious." I thought I was on the threshold of my life. Just after midnight, I phoned my mother with the news. She was both thrilled and saddened. Although she didn't say it, I knew she was thinking that the marriage meant that I would live very far away from her for the rest of our lives. But she was a woman of curiosity and enthusiasm, and I could tell she was also excited by the idea that I had gone to an odd little corner of the world and found myself a solid and loving man to marry. She, too, had a solid and loving husband by then, Stan, whom she'd met in her 50s, and it eased my conscience a bit to know she wasn't on her own. My mother had never lived with my father. She had raised me herself, in a cozy, modest house in the suburb of Portland. She worked as the administrator in the philosophy department at a university in the city, which is how she met my father, a professor of philosophy at a college in Maine who had come to Portland for a semester. My mother was 38 that spring. She'd been engaged some years before and had broken it off when it became clear that her fiancé expected her to fall in line with whatever life decisions he made, a perfectly common assumption in the late 50s, but one that filled my mother with dread. My mother may not have known what she wanted, but she knew what she didn't want. The day after I got engaged was a Sunday, and we were expected at Eddie's parents' house for lunch. One of his sisters was down from Dublin for the weekend, and we were going to announce our engagement. On the way, we stopped at Slattery's on High Street for a drink. Eddie knew everyone there. The man who was something big at the pharmaceutical plant, two guys home on leave from the Lebanon, a cluster of plump old ladies who were somehow connected to a family celebrating a boy's first communion. We nestled into a corner table and ordered pints of Guinness. "We're getting married," I thought. And it was as though the very air between us was charged with the secret. We were sitting on a cushioned bench, Eddie had one thick thigh crossed over the other, and he was wagging his right foot gently. He was wearing beautiful Italian brogues and talking to the man next to him, laughing at something a little too loudly. And then suddenly he turned to me, rested his hand on my leg, and asked softly, was I okay? You okay there, pet? Can I get you something? It was there in the tone. I knew that I was loved as I had never been before. I don't mean that Eddie loved me with remarkable passion or insight. I don't mean that I felt most fully myself with him. I mean that, in the strangest way, I felt forgiven. For as long as I could remember, there'd been a vague disquiet in me, as if I lived in the shadow of some humiliation whose particulars I could not recall. Until he absolved me. I hadn't known there was any other way to feel. The pubs closed at 1 o'clock on a Sunday, and when the time came for drinking up, we were all cast out into the grim white light, a vague, half-sad tipsiness upon us. Eddie drove us back through town, down O'Connell Street, past the tea house where I'd had my lunches the previous summer, past the drapers and the newsagents and the tatty shopping arcade whose tiled floor was always lethal with the slick of rain, past the hairdressers with the sign that read, with no comic intent, appointments necessary if possible, past the doctors with the shingle hanging over the door that read, surgery. We crossed the bridge and headed north. On the Donegal Road, in the dip between Ballytivnan and the river, were the travellers' caravans. In summer, they'd had about them something brassy and defiant, but now they seemed forlorn. Two small children tottered, dazed or truculent, in the grass on the wet verge. Strewn around outside the caravans were clothes and pots and pans, generators and furniture, and the whole tableau, even the children, looked like the aftermath of a natural disaster. Eddie's mother came from farming stock. Her people owned untold acres of good land in Clare. She had all the pragmatism and know-how that came with being reared close to the land, but she had, too, a way of swanning into a room that was almost operatic. She knew her wines and made creme brulee from scratch. Eddie's father came from a different sort of background, a grubby little cottage near the Roscommon border, a bit of land, a few dairy cows. He had migrated to the town as a young man and worked his way up from shop boy at a building contractor's company to manager, then co-owner, before gradually acquiring a number of properties in the town center. I wanted to like him, for his audacity and lack of pretense, and because rheumatoid arthritis had confined him to a wheelchair. But I never could, for he was also coarse and demanding, and often dismissive. I gathered that he had once been a strapping man of figure and rough good looks. Now he sat in his wheelchair, drinking whiskey and smoking cigarettes, and I dreaded the moments, however brief, when we were left alone together. In his presence, I felt frivolous and insufficient. I would attempt to be of use by fetching him something, and then I would feel ashamed for being able to get up and walk. I am certain he thought mobility was wasted on me. Perhaps he thought it wasted on us all. He and Eddie's mother lived in a house with gardens front and back, which were tended by an aging man who had been with them forever. They also had a woman who was there most days, doing housework, and on Sundays helping to cook the lunches we attended. She was flitting and shadowy, discreet to the point of ghostliness. I had never been in a house where there was help. When I was a child, my mother employed a woman named Lula, who came every other week to clean. Her flesh was discernible in rolls beneath the tight, nubby polyester tops she wore, and I remember her as raucous and indiscreet. My mother sometimes sat with her at the small formica table in our kitchen, talking women's talk, and more than once I saw Lula sobbing, I am tempted to say blubbering, running a chubby finger up beneath the lenses of her spectacles, which were always misted and oily-looking. Eddie had two sisters, both younger. Nessa lived in Toronto, but Celia came down some weekends from Dublin, where she was an accounts manager at a bank. She was married to a man named Jerry, who did something in finance. Celia and Jerry dined at Dublin's only Michelin-starred restaurant and had a home alarm system that knew exactly where they were and would buzz their beepers if there was trouble. Eddie's mother shook her head and said it sounded ghastly, by which she meant their entire existence in that money-grubbing and amoral city, not just the fact that it included beepers. I had nothing much in common with Celia, but I liked her. Unlike Eddie's parents, she never treated me as though there was some secret to belonging I'd never be let in on. She made me feel it was okay that I didn't know how to make Christmas pudding or elderflower cordial, and that I came from nowhere in particular. When Eddie and I announced our engagement that day, all of us in the sitting room after lunch, with a fire roaring and a wet dusk settling outside, it was Celia who declared it brilliant news and jumped up from the sofa to congratulate us. Eddie's mother looked at us with a frozen smile and said, "Well, I didn't expect that." There was a beat of silence, then Eddie's father cleared his throat and raised his whiskey in a toast. From my third-floor window, I can see the east and west piers of Dunleary Harbor, curling like the pincers of something risen from the seabed. I can see the ferries from Holyhead hoving into view, a little sleeker now than when I was a passenger, and less redolent of exile and finality. What I can see, in fact, is my own point of entry, the port at which I first arrived more than 25 years ago. The coincidence thrills me, though it's hardly astonishing. There are few things on earth smaller than this country. The house belongs to friends of a friend, a retired couple who are in Canada visiting their son, and will later go to Australia to visit their daughter. It is part of a Victorian terrace, and there is an air of decorum and seemliness about it that is like no house I've ever inhabited. My favorite part of it is the entryway, which smells strongly of the sea. This whole island was once underwater, and I'd like to imagine that this large foyer, with its sideboard and its wall mirror and its umbrella stand, has retained the memory of that. I think of shell middens found on mountaintops. I half expect to find a fish fossil in the floor tiles. When I remarked, with wonder, on the smell, "How lovely to be this close to the sea," the owners of the house expressed puzzlement. They claimed never to have noticed it, and I thought to myself, they have really lost it. But within days of my moving in, that once overwhelming sea smell began to fade, so that I found myself sniffing hard when I came in the front door, searching for it, missing it. I've taken the house for 6 months, until I decide what to do, where to go. After my mother died, I left Nairobi, where I'd been working for an Irish NGO, and took a consultant's contract and moved back here. Over the years, I had sometimes imagined that I might one day live in Ireland again, but it was not until my mother died that I came back. I was exhausted, by work and by grief, and so far from any person I had ever felt attached to, or anywhere that had ever felt like home. When I thought about where home might be, I realized, somewhat to my surprise, that Dublin, where I'd lived for a time after leaving Eddie, seemed the closest approximation. They've got me writing a year-end report on our work in the world's largest refugee camp, Dadaab, in eastern Kenya. This afternoon I'm meeting the head of our Dublin office, Harry, to discuss it, though it is already clear to me that it won't differ radically from last year's. It's not that nothing happens in Dadaab. There are, after all, almost 500,000 unhappy people there. It's that many things happen, but very little changes. Somalis keep arriving. Today, I've been reading through case studies written by field workers, looking for a bit of human interest I might include. There was a Somali woman named Hamdi who set herself on fire outside the office. She had 5 children. Their father had been murdered by men from a rival clan, and Hamdi had become a sex worker in the camp to support her family. If she were caught, she risked being burned alive or otherwise put to death. So it was the grimmest of ironies that she had, at the end of her tether, attempted to call attention to her plight by setting fire to herself and almost dying in the process. Apparently it worked. After several months, Hamdi and her children were resettled in Germany. We can imagine the possibility of a happy ending. Even so, the tale is simply too grisly to include. What I would like to explore in my report, and what is certainly not my job to explore, is the question of which is more shocking, barbarity or the capacity to survive it. When I started in this line of work, brutality shocked me more. Now, survival does. For all the times I've seen people come out the other side of horrors with their sanity seemingly intact, I have never really understood how it is done. I work at a desk beside the window, watching the weather like it's television. This morning it snowed, lightly. The flakes were blowing about, harum-scarum, and it wasn't entirely clear where they were coming from. Apart from a few tufty and benign-looking clouds, the sky was blue. When the flurries eventually stopped, a haze formed, slowly obscuring Sutton and Hoth. A darkish band took shape along the horizon, growing gradually lighter and more diffuse as it rose, as though the water surface was on fire, and this was smoke. The haze thickened to the point of obscuring the sea itself. The fire went out. Hoth and Sutton sank. I saw in every direction only a gray mass, as solid as a rock face. My mother asked me once, a little rhetorically, "Doesn't anything surprise you?" She meant surprise, as in astound. She meant I had no sense of wonder. We were sitting in her living room in a retirement complex in Florida, and she was cooing in amazement as I demonstrated, yet again, how text messaging worked. I wanted us to be able to text each other while I was in Nairobi, and that must have been the fourth time we'd gone over it. Each time, she had shaken her head as though she were witnessing the miracle of flight. I believe that a part of her really was amazed, and I thought maybe she belonged to the last generation capable of astonishment. "It's pretty exciting," I said, with more sarcasm than I'd intended. She looked hurt, and rightly so, and I felt like a bully. Anyway, who was I to scoff? I have no idea how text messaging actually works. And that was when she said it. "Doesn't anything surprise you?" Later, we walked down the back path and sat in a very gentle April sun and waited for the jitney to bring us to the beach. We shared a small bag of potato chips and discovered we both loved the ones with the little pillows of air in them, and neither of us could quite say why, but the discovery felt extraordinary, as though it were something genuinely important, and we could not see why it had taken decades for us to stumble on it. For a moment, she seemed positively girlish, beside herself with delight. I looked at her shyly and had to turn my head away for an instant and gather myself. I think I knew by then. I knew somehow that it wouldn't be long. Still, her death astonished me, like nothing ever has. At some point during my last year in Nairobi, my mother, who had been youthful all her life, even into her 80s, her gait steady, her enthusiasm undiminished, her eyes bright, grew abruptly older. I began to mourn her, preemptively. The mere thought of her caused my heart to buckle. While she was still healthy, I made a decision that I would go and live near her, or perhaps even with her, during her last years on Earth. I would go, I thought, before autumn. And then, the next time I was visiting, she had a small stroke. Was it the first? I wasn't even sure. And I began to panic. After that, I traveled twice in 3 months to see her. When she died, my colleagues thought I would stay in Nairobi. They said, "Don't make any rash decisions," and one foot in front of the other. But her death changed me. When I returned to Nairobi after her funeral, I felt my mother everywhere. I was awash in an indiscriminate tenderness I neither expected nor understood. Everything moved me. Everything, from a bird call, to the green of the grass, to the children playing soccer on the pitch near my home, overwhelmed me with its life. I swung between a lightness of being that bordered on vertigo, and a sorrow that made the least movement difficult. In my grief, I felt awakened to the world, and a strange, acute euphoria sometimes stole over me. What I felt, in fact, was perpetually astonished. Harry said he needs a break from the office, so we're meeting at the Fitzwilliam for coffee. He's already there when I arrive. We order, and he asks me first not about the progress of my report, but about my mother, or rather, how I'm doing since she died. I shrug. He nods. I say that grief seems to me a set of contradictions. It's like the opposite of vigilance, I say. But the apathy is so keyed up. Everything is heightened or intensified. And yet I seem